Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, August 12th. We get the primary election wrap up. How did the turnout affect the many races that went unchallenged? Well, though we did see surprise upsets. A settlement in a lawsuit against the National Association of Realtors kicks in next weekend. So what are Hawaii realtors being told in advance of the changes? We get empowered by a champion martial arts fighter turned youth motivational speaker. How can we nip bullying in the bud as our children go back to school? Plus, Hawaii high schools are adding girls flag football to its roster of sports. We learn what led to the decision and how it's all going to work. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The turnout for this past weekend's primary election was said to be the lowest ever. So how did that affect the outcome of races? Joining us this morning is HPR reporter Ashley Mizuo, who was tracking the election this weekend. Long weekend for you.
Yeah, good morning. I guess just to get to the crux of it, let's first talk about the main race, which is between Kim Koko Iwamoto and Speaker Scott Saiki. Kim Koko Iwamoto got 49% of the vote, beating Saiki, who got 44.6%, which is a difference of about 254 votes. This is the third time they've gone up against each other in 2022. Saiki won by just 160 votes. 2020, just about 167. He spent $284,000, and Kim Koko Iwamoto spent $140,000. And, you know, I have to say that's a huge amount of money, but not the most, because Mayor Blangiardi, who was not in a competitive race, spent $1.8 million on his campaign. But going back to Saiki and Kim Koko Iwamoto, you know, it's going to signal a huge change in the legislature because they will now need to pick a new speaker. And Scott Saiki has been speaker since 2017 and been a member of the House since 1994. And, you know, they're already talking amongst themselves, the leadership in the House, you know, as to who will become the next speaker of the House. They'll officially vote on it when they come back into session in January. But historically, these types of decisions are made, you know, behind the scenes amongst themselves beforehand. It was really notable to me that at the Democrats' traditional post-primary unity breakfast yesterday, they put forth House Majority Leader Nadine Nakamura to speak on behalf of the House. And while Speaker Saiki was present, he did not make any speeches. But many of the speeches that were made yesterday included remarks about him and his leadership. So here is Representative Nadine Nakamura.
Speaker Saiki has done so much for our state of Hawaii. His work over the years is, I would say, he has done so much for working families. He has done so much in the area of renewable energy, the environment, historic funding for natural resources and preservation. There's a lot that he has built that we need to build on in the future.
And, you know, she told me that change after an election is common, and that's important now for Democrats to come together.
And it happens as part of the cycle, and when voters have a say in the democratic process, this is what happens. So it will be a leadership transition, and we will work together. The bottom line is that the needs of the families of Hawaii are addressed and taken care of.
Do we know, you know, what impact the turnout had in that race at all?
I'm not sure. I kind of just on a brief glance, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but from what I remember, I think it was lower than in the past in terms of how many people came out and voted for both Kim Koko Iwamoto and Speaker Saiki, because I think the numbers back in 2020 were just significantly elevated compared to 2024. I can't remember the numbers for 2022.
Right, though. Yeah, it makes you wonder because you had so many races that were uncontested, but it's lower turnout, and these are the results. But so it's interesting that, you know, Nadine could be next
yeah,
month.
Yeah, and you know, she represents Kapa'a on Kauai. She started her career in city planning in Honolulu and then went on to Kauai County Council, and she was for a little while Kauai County Managing Director, and then has been in the House of Representatives since 2016. You know, one thing that's really stuck out to me is that when Speaker Saiki entered the House in 1994, he was seen as part of kind of this more progressive faction of Democrats when Calvin Tsai was the Speaker back then. And like, for example, he was one of the very few members of the legislature that voted against a constitutional amendment in 1997 to allow the legislature to limit marriage between man and woman. And then last session, he put forward legislation to get that amendment removed, so voters will have an opportunity to weigh in on that in November as a constitutional amendment question. And, you know, and then we flash forward 30 years after he, you know, has been elected for the first time in 1994. And Kim Koko Iwamoto has positioned herself that way as, you know, a more progressive candidate with now Speaker Saiki as an establishment Democrat.
Yeah. And it was interesting to me that Clayton He, who had the endorsement of three governors, didn't make it in his race against his fellow Democrat. So, yeah, you wonder what was going on in voters' minds about, you know, the machine or tradition.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's another thing that was, you know, these kind of big names or establishment candidates who weren't necessarily incumbents, but were supposed to be, you know, like pretty well known and seen as more established Democrats. They didn't really do super well in this race. You know, as you said, former lawmaker Clayton He lost against community organizer Ben Schaefer in the North Shore race. You know, Ken Inouye, who's the late Senator Dan Inouye's son, challenged Representative Trish LaChica and was unsuccessful. Some other incumbents who didn't make it through, Representative Sonny Gannadin lost to Shirley Timpolo. Representative May Mizuno, who was appointed just recently by Governor Green, lost to Ikaika Hussey, who has been trying to get into elected office since 2016. And then we also saw Representative Natalia Hussey-Burdick lose to Mike Lee out in Windward Side.
Yeah, so there's some new faces that will be coming in January.
Yeah, some new faces and a lot of rematches that kind of flipped the other direction. But, you know, heading into the general in November, here's what I think we kind of can expect. Democrats are gunning to unseat Senator Brenton Awa, really focusing on pushing Ben Schaefer, who we just talked about. Here's Democratic Party Chair Derek Turbin.
I think if you looked at the turnout, both Democratic candidates, Schaefer and Clayton, got more votes than Brenton Awa. So that's really promising. You know, I think we got a good shot to flip some seats out on the west side. We got to protect the seats out in Waianae, Maile, but also see if we can flip a couple of those too.
And we heard, you know, those same kind of sentiments heard from Senate President Ron Kochi during his speech at Sunday's Unity Breakfast.
We are going to need to turn the vote out to help Cedric Gates retain the seat held by Maile Shinobu. We are going to need that turnout to help Ben Schaefer, who was nominated last night, to beat the incumbent Republican. And treat the Republican representation in the Senate back to one. But it's not going to happen without your hard work.
And, you know, they're referring to Senate District 3, which was held by Maile Shimabukuro, a Democrat, for 21 years. Representative Cedric Gates won his primary race and will be facing Republican Samantha DeCourt in the general election. And, you know, the Republicans didn't have a unity breakfast this year, but instead are going to be hosting candidate forums leading up to the general election. And so, you know, overall voter turnout was down, as you said, in the primary at just 31%. In 2022, it was almost 40%. But I think we can expect a bump going into the general because it is a presidential election year. And I think a lot of people will be turning out to vote for either Vice President Kamala Harris or former President Donald Trump.
Yeah, and we'll see if the Republicans make any headway. I mean, you know, the last go around, the Republicans did add a few more seats.
Yeah.
But we'll see if that holds.
We'll see. And I think the race to watch going into the general is going to be between Brenton Awa and Ben Schaefer.
In the Senate, right?
Yeah.
And if they can, I guess as the Democrats say, right, get back to the the Lone Ranger, where there's only one Republican.
Right, exactly.
In the Senate. Yeah.
Which is Senator Kurt Favela. Yeah.
Right, right. So, but there was even some internal strife there. I don't think they ever really figured out the minority leader,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I'm not sure they're completely aligned either. So it's going to be the race to watch, I think, and I think there's going to be a lot of campaigning on both sides. You know, Brenton Ah was very good at social media. He's like very much used that in his campaigns, and I think that's been a huge way that he's gained so many votes in the past. So we'll have to watch and see what happens.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Ashley. We've been talking to HBR's Ashley Mizzou about the outcome of this past weekend's primary election. We'll have all the results on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, offering tips to help prepare for emergencies, such as gas safety and using a propane-powered backup generator. Learn more at hawaiigas.com.
Aloha, this is Bert Lum, host of Bite Marks Cafe. The show has moved to a new day and time, Fridays at 6:30 p.m. on HPR 1. Join us as we showcase the creativity and innovation in Hawaii's tech community. Download past episodes of Bite Marks Cafe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the free HBR app. Bite Marks Cafe, now on Fridays at 6:30 p.m. on HBR 1.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
On August 17th, the historic settlement agreement impacts the real estate industry kicks in. It stems from a lawsuit filed against the National Association of Realtors over its practice of setting commissions. We're told that the settlement doesn't have much effect on commercial sales, which traditionally negotiated commissions, but it could mean changes for residential sales because up until the legal challenge, buyers may not have known that commissions were negotiable since the fees were often spelled out in the forms. Leading up to this weekend, thousands of Hawaii realtors have been signing up for training sessions to better understand how those changes will affect them. It will mean new forms. Julie Meyer is the president of the Hawaii Association of Realtors, who has been conducting the virtual training workshop statewide.
What we really want to make sure that everyone understands is the settlement doesn't fundamentally change the way people buy or sell homes in Hawaii. That remains the same. Fees will continue to be negotiable between consumers and the realtors. And overall, the settlement will be beneficial because it's allowing us to communicate and be very transparent on the buyer broker fees and listing fees between agents and buyers and sellers. So we do encourage everyone, if they can, view the NAR settlement FAQs at facts.realtor. All the questions, it's all broken out by different topics, so you can get the answers there. And I think that's where that comfort level comes back. Everyone's a little nervous when they hear a change, when they hear settlement and things like that. But if you look at what it really is and see how we're implementing it, it's just a matter of educating and having the knowledge to do the changes that need to be done.
And it used to be that if you sold your home, it was pretty much spelled out, right, about the commissions that the agents were going to get as part of the deal.
Right. So what currently is happening and what will change on August 17th, what's currently happening is when a seller lists their property, they have a compensation agreed upon, and part of that is shared with the buyer's broker. So now the change is that the buyer's broker will now negotiate directly with the buyer's agent on that compensation. So that was the significant change. That was a change. And another change is that our MLSs, where we have all of our listings there, will no longer have any information about buyer compensation.
And it used to be, what, about 6% in commissions, correct?
It varied. It really varied by the brokerage firm and the type of real estate that was being practiced, whether it was school service or not.
Okay, but I mean, just generally, for, let's say, residential sales, what will realtors now be forced to do?
Well, so what will happen is, instead of that X percent that's agreed upon by the listing and with the seller, then the listing agent, and then they take that and share it, instead, they'll only have their percentage that they'll be paid. And so a listing agent will be compensated by the seller, and then they can also continue to offer to pay for a buyer's broker fee, because a lot of times you want to really open up and expose your property to as many buyers as possible. Not all buyers are going to be able to pay the buyer's brokers. So we foresee that there will still be sellers that will want to compensate the buyer's agents.
Well, some folks are saying, well, the settlement essentially means that there's going to be less money for the agents, for the brokers and the realtors.
We don't anticipate that, just because it's all about being able to show what your value of your service is. And we believe that the sellers and buyers and the consumers, knowing the value, will still want to pay the commissions and compensation to the agents.
Well, in the past, when it's been spelled out on those forms, you know, via the contract, mm-hmm. Now that will not be listed. And so I imagine, though, it's going to be on the onus of the realtors to justify their services and, you know, why they should be compensated.
Right. So as I mentioned, it's always been negotiable, but a lot of times, because the sellers were paying for the buyer's agents, brokers, it wasn't really talked about much on the buyer's side because of the compensation coming from the listing agent. So now it's time to talk about that. And it will be broken out. There will be transparency. There will be better communication. And so we feel that that will probably help in the situation as far as compensation. We don't see compensation going down. Time will tell. It's not August 17th yet. But as it is right now, we don't see much change as long as the consumers understand the value that they get working with a realtor.
Just anecdotally, I know of a couple of realtors that have just decided to hang it up based on just the market conditions and have maybe switched over to 9-to-5 jobs. How do you see this impacting, you know, the number of realtors out there in Hawaii?
Well, right now, this year, 2024, it is a renewal year. And whenever we have a renewal year with the DCCA licensing, we tend to see a few agents that leave the business. But at this time, we haven't seen many surrendering their license. I believe this is due in large part to the educational sessions that we've been having that the Hawaii Association of Realtors is offering to its members. Agents are now equipped and with revised forms and practice changes required with the settlement agreement. So at first, when, of course, you hear lawsuit and whatnot, you panic. But like I said, we did the training. We went through everything. The forms are going to be ready. The educational sessions continue, and they're very well attended. And this is giving the agents the confidence to move through with the settlement agreement.
How many realtors do we have here in Hawaii? How many members do you have?
About 11,000, the Hawaii Association of Realtors, about 11,000 now. It's one of the highest that we've been. A lot of time through COVID, we saw an influx of agents during that time, too.
Interesting. And so you won't know until the end of the year what the picture looks like if people have decided to hang it up.
Exactly. We have to just kind of give it time. We know that there's always some that fall out whenever it's coming to the license renewals. But right now, we won't know until we finish the renewals and see if there's, you know, a large impact due to this.
Well, I imagine, though, in talking with my realtor friends, that it's not just this settlement. You know, they're seeing that, you know, there isn't a lot of inventory out there, right? We've just gotten behind on building new homes, and there's a push now, but that combined with interest rates and, you know, the problems that we're having with the insurance on condos, that some are just saying, I don't know.
Yeah, it almost sounds like a perfect storm, doesn't it?
Yes, but, it's difficult times.
You know, we always look that the interest rates go up, the interest rates go down. There's always people that need to buy and always people that need to sell. It would be dependent maybe on lifestyle. Maybe they need to downsize. They need more of a home. They're moving. There's so many different reasons that people sell. So they'll continue to sell whether or not the rates are high or low. That's something that will always be there. The insurance, that's something the governor is working with now. He just passed his emergency proclamation, and they'll be working on, you know, whatever they can to help the condominium associations with their insurance, getting insured. So we're hoping that will take place soon.
There's a lot of pressure there, but we did just see the interest rates go down a bit, I think.
Yeah, so we watch it really closely. But we also really listen to our buyers and our sellers. And if there's a need to sell now, we're there for them. We're there to help and guide them through everything.
And so as we approach the 17th, then after that, folks just need to know there's going to be new forms to fill out based on the settlement agreement.
That's correct. There's no change to the process of buying and selling. We've got some new forms and we'll explain more and we'll actually have more conversation about how the compensation works. So I see it as a good thing, and I think our industry will always get better.
Anything else that you think would be important to underscore for our listeners?
I think it's just really important to make sure that you're working with a realtor. So a realtor member has to abide by a very strict code of ethics, and that stands true through your entire contract, your entire process. We're here, we have the knowledge and the experience. So if you have any questions, please reach out to a realtor or you can call the Hawaii Association of Realtors for more information.
That was Julie Marr with the Honolulu Board of Realtors. The State Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs says because the settlement is between two private entities, it is not directly involved. But some industry watchers, wonder if it will make transactions less costly. It remains to be seen how buyers and sellers will use this settlement to their advantage.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
People in southern Turkey are still rebuilding after massive earthquakes there in 2022. A new surfing school is helping one beach town feel like home again.
Surfing is the way that helped them to reconnect again. You know, a reason to wake up in the morning.
Tune in for that story and the day's global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929 for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardOfWaterSupply.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. You know, the Paris Olympics just ended yesterday, so we're delving into the history of competitive swimming. Spectators were wowed in Paris by Maryland native Katie Ledecky's athleticism, taking home 2 gold, 1 silver, and 1 bronze at this year's Games. Her total medal count of 14 makes her the second most decorated U.S. Olympian behind Michael Phelps. He's still the most decorated of all time with 28. Here in Hawaii, many of us are familiar with legendary waterman Duke Kahanamoku. Known around the world for popularizing the sport of surfing, Duke was also a five-time Olympic medalist. He won back-to-back gold medals in the 100-meter freestyle at Stockholm back in 1912 and in Antwerp in 1920, as well as gold and silver medals in team relay events. For this morning's quiz, though, we want to know if you can tell us who was Hawaii's first female Olympian. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Chris Wamilo is a former champion in the Thai martial arts called Muay Thai, which focuses on kicks and punches. Today, Wamilo is a motivational speaker, or as he calls it, a youth empowerment specialist. He visited three middle schools on Oahu last week to talk about anti-bullying as students began the new school year. Wamilo came by our studio last week and spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender. He shared his experiences about, you know, being bullied as a Filipino and learning how to get back up in the face of adversity.
I've been a youth empowerment speaking now, I would say off and on, for a good 5 or 6 years. So yeah, I've been to the west coast of the mainland, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. So yeah, I've bounced around.
You were a professional, a champion, Muay Thai.
Yeah, yeah. That was my past life, I guess, the last chapter of my life. Where, yeah, I was a professional Muay Thai champion. And, you know, I always say that it was a sport that saved me.
You had some experiences with bullying as a child. Can you talk a bit about what that was like growing up, how bullying impacted you?
Yeah, there were actually a couple instances. So I was originally from Elmhurst, New York, Elmhurst, Queens. I grew up there till about 8 years old. And then my parents were immigrants from the Philippines. My mom found a place in Queens Village or Jamaica, New York, which wasn't that far away. But when we moved out there, you know, in hopes of bettering our lives, things didn't get much better. Unfortunately, my brother and I, we were the only Filipino kids in my school. So yeah, I would say I faced some bullying challenges, you know, being the only, I guess, Asian American in my school and in my class. You know, I would get picked on. I'll never forget. I tell this story in my talks about how one day in gym class, two classmates grabbed me by the throat and, you know, they threatened me. And, you know, being the new kid in school, it sent some quick messages that, wow, okay, school's going to be rough. Because I came from, you know, Elmhurst, Queens, where it was predominantly, you know, everybody kind of looked like me. I wasn't the only Asian kid there. So, you know, it was definitely a 180. But not just that, I was also abused by my fourth grade teacher. He was physically abusive. And that on top of, you know, being picked on by kids and school definitely wasn't my safe place, I guess, so yeah, to speak.
All of those things alone are awful. Combined, it's a really tough situation. And yeah, like what did you do?
Not much. I definitely, you know, I actually tell the kids this in my talks. Like, it's great because nowadays there's so much support and help for things like bullying or having mental health awareness. You know, back when I was growing up in the 80s, there wasn't a lot of that. And nothing against my parents, but, you know, they didn't have that awareness either. Luckily, I got into Bruce Lee. And actually, my father got me into martial arts. He exposed me to martial arts at a young age. So I just remember as a young kid, like 8, 9, maybe 10 years old, I would run home. My mom, she bought me a heavy bag and I put it in my garage and I would just go in there and work out. You know, I remember setting up my own pull-up bar with a pipe. You know, I finagled the way to keep it up top on the garage rafters. And I would just work out. And that was my salvation. That garage kept me free from whatever was going on in the schools, but also what was going on at home. You know, I remember telling myself as a kid, I was like, all right, I might not be able to fight these bullies off, but at least I can let my anger and my frustration out in push-ups and hitting the heavy bag and just being physical. So being physical for me was definitely my outlet.
Yeah. And then, I mean, you grew up and you became quite a successful fighter at that, right?
Yeah.
Championship winning.
Yeah. I mean, it was, especially the moment that it happened, it was just like a culmination of everything that you go through over the years. And you're like, wow, okay, this is what it was all for that feeling. But it was funny because that moment was so brief. You feel like you worked your whole life for this one moment in the ring. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, okay, now what?
So tell me about that transition then to this next stage in your career as an empowerment specialist.
I guess before I got into speaking, I would say what really led to that is opening up my gym, my first gym. It's funny because my wife is from New Jersey. I'm from Queens, but she took me out to Rockaway Beach, Queens. And I didn't even know about Rockaway Beach, living in Queens my whole life. And we literally just sat on the beach together. We weren't married yet, but I was like, this is it. This is where I can literally plant my roots. Once we decided gym, like this is what we want to do. We're like, okay, this is what we want to do, not just for the adults, but for the kids in the community. Because we saw how challenged and underprivileged the kids were coming from the projects or broken homes and things like that. And for me, looking back on my life, I wish I had something to keep me on the straight and narrow. So that just made so much sense for us where we built this gym. We started a scholarship program for at-risk kids in the community. And in that process, that's where I found my passion for going out and speaking. I got this one gig as a speaker for an anti-bullying organization that I was working for. And I was like, wow, that feeling of before you get on stage to actually talk, it replicated what I used to feel before going into a fight. I was craving that since I retired from fighting. So I would say that was the impetus to say, okay, how can I use my struggles to help other kids' struggles and help them through those obstacles and challenges in life?
What has changed since the time you were growing up and what has stayed the same with respect to bullying and the other challenges that students might face?
Oh, that's a great question because we definitely dive into that into my talk. Where, yeah, I mean, growing up, you know, bullying obviously wasn't so anonymous, right? It was in your face. And for me, a lot of times I didn't deal with it. I tried to run from it and hide. But then that was kind of a blessing in disguise because I could run home, right? And dodge it for 8, 9, 10 hours. But then you'd come back to it the next day at school. So it's absolutely so much harder for these kids nowadays. And obviously because of technology, the double-edged sword of technology. It's a blessing, but now you can't run from it because it's wherever you go. It's on your phone. It's at home on whatever screen you got at home. So yeah, I mean, that's absolutely the main challenge of it, that it could be a 24/7 thing, you know, going on for a lot of these kids. And it's a shame, you know, because again, with the blessing of technology, we can stay in contact. But then that flip side of it is like, you can't hide from it. I don't want to be negative and say it's a losing battle, but it's an uphill climb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is there anything in particular you've seen in Hawaii schools over the past few days? I know kids are just coming back to school. So is now the best time to talk about bullying, kind of nip that in the bud and set expectations going into the school year?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, anytime you can, I always say, you plant the seed, right? You plant the seed of hope. And with working with schools, teachers, you know, counselors, you nurture that seed and hopefully it blooms. But yeah, absolutely. Go in there as early as possible and set the standard for the school year. My main message is that how can we strengthen our inner resolve so that we can handle what's going on outside of us? We can't control life circumstances, right? We can't control events. We can't control wildfires. We can't control hurricanes. We can't control earthquakes. But what you can do is understand, okay, accept the reality of the situation. Now, what can I do to move forward?
Would you say that your approach kind of focuses more on the potential targets or victims of bullying, or brings the bullies into it too? Or how do you think about those two groups of people?
I want to approach it collectively. So I actually said it today in a couple of speeches. This is not just for the kid that's feeling the pain and the suffering of being bullied. This is also for the kid who might be dishing out the negativity. And I tell them that because I know from experience myself, like all the negativity that I was experiencing in school and what was going on with things at home, I didn't know how to cope. So I started being negative to people around me. I became, if anything, I became like a bully. I'm not condoning what a kid is doing by going out and putting something on Snapchat and saying something, but I can kind of understand where they're coming from. They're hurting too. Something's going on in their life that's causing them to want to spread negativity. So I definitely want to approach it from both sides and not just say, point fingers and say, oh, it's just that kid. There's something wrong with him. He or she's in pain. And unfortunately, you know, I tell the kids, hurt people hurt people.
Yeah. Any notes of hope, any ways that in us all coming together, we can protect and help today's young people?
The message I share is that we're all champions, right? I truly believe we're all champions deep down inside. And I share with the kids, like, being a champion just doesn't mean you've got to win belts and titles and all this accolades and stuff like that. Being a champion is a choice. And as champions, we're going to face challenges in our life. But sometimes we think it's about what is happening to us. More so is about what's happening inside of us. So how do we battle? I say we battle self-doubt, fear, disappointment, hardship, confusion, ego, and negative self-talk. If we can handle that, then I truly believe we can handle any life circumstance that comes with us. So what's interesting is any youth assembly that I give, I always get at least one or two adults that come up after me and they're like, wow, thank you for that. And I'm like, well, thank you. I appreciate that, because if it's a reminder for you, it's a reminder for me. I never claim to have figured it all out. I battle those things on a daily basis. So if anything, this is just a reminder for all of us. Like, how can we wake up every morning and say, okay, this is what's holding me down, but I have a choice. I can choose to let it hold me down, or I can choose, okay, let me figure out a way around, over, through, under this obstacle.
Is there anything else you want to add? Any advice for listeners who might be parents or who might be going through a tough situation?
You know, what I've learned over the years, you know, with the trauma, the family trauma that I've dealt with. So I would say to parents or even kids, like, you know, don't sweep that stuff under the rug. Be open to talk about it, because the family trauma is what can hold you back. And what I've learned is we all have some sort of family trauma. And if you can address that and acknowledge it, you can eventually move forward from it. Not overnight, but, you know, that journey. So yeah, I would say look deep within and see really what's held you back and then address it and move forward. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Are there any easy Muay Thai moves you could teach me?
Yes, absolutely.
Let me see what you think about this. I have a friend who does Muay Thai, and she was telling me I can, like, kind of have my arm like this and act like I'm playing with my ear. So if someone were to come up behind me, could just
I like that.
Elbow back.
That's great. No, that is great. I call that a non-violent posture, which prepares you for fighting, right? Yeah. Another way you can do it is like if you're actually in an altercation, like a face-to-face altercation, and you're able to address it, keep your hands up, but in a non-violent way. Like, look, I just want to talk, right? But then, yeah, you have those elbows. Yeah, or this is not so much Muay Thai. This is more self-defense, but fingers to the eyes. Yeah. And then if you want to go back to Muay Thai, hit them with a knee.
Nice. Make it a whole combination.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You definitely need combos.
Yeah.
That was Chris Romulo and HPR's Maddie Bender. Romulo shared with us that his first gym in Rockaway, Queens was destroyed in 2012's Hurricane Sandy, but with help from the Muay Thai community, they were able to rebuild the training center. His advice, accept reality, choose to fight.
Support for HPR comes from TS Restaurants and its Legacy of Aloha Foundation, supporting the Maui community and assisting those affected by the wildfires. More about how to help by searching tsrestaurants.com Legacy of Aloha.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30. Here on HPR One.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
And now it's time for the Backyard Quiz Answer. Earlier, we asked you to name the first female Olympian from Hawaii. If you've been to Waimea on the Big Island, our quiz subject's name may be familiar to you. She developed a love for painting in the 1940s and was instrumental in establishing and promoting the Waimea Arts Council. The council hosted an annual juried art show at the Firehouse Gallery in her name. Before finding her passion in art, she was a gifted swimmer. She learned her craft at Coconut Island in Hilo and later trained at the Outrigger Canoe Club in Honolulu. In 1920, she qualified for the U.S. Olympic swim team as a freshman at Punahou, and she traveled to Belgium for the Antwerp Olympics, the same games where Duke Kahanamoku won two gold medals. So who was this multi-talented Renaissance woman? Well, it was Hilo-born Helen Cassidy. And although she missed out on the podium in Antwerp, Cassidy has carved out a place in Hawaii's history in both sports and the arts. And thanks to Mark Sakamoto for today's quiz. And our winner, Leslie Hong from Kahala. If you have an idea for a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaii's high schools will soon be adding the first new girls' sport in more than 20 years, flag football. The season will start next spring and will be offered at all public high schools and a few private schools. Hawaii is the 12th state to sanction the sport. Interest in football and playing football is growing among females. The International Federation of American Football estimates that about 500,000 girls under 17 in the U.S. participate in organized play. In 2028, women's flag football will be part of the Olympics in Los Angeles. The Conversation's Russell Subiono was curious about what led to the decision and how it worked. So he called up Chris Chun, the executive director of the Hawaii High School Athletic Association.
What led to the decision to establish girls flag football across public and private schools in Hawaii?
I think it was like a kind of a perfect storm in a good way. There's interest obviously in it in the Hawaii high schools. I mean, you can go around any park in any state, in any island, I should say, and there's girls flag football leagues on all the islands. The NFL has shown a big interest in promoting this sport to all the states, so they've stepped up their sponsorship levels. There was a public informal survey sent to the public schools, and this was one of the top sports. It's one that athletic directors and the leagues can buy into because there's limited amount for equipment. The facilities are already set up to host this kind of stuff. So it's kind of like a whole bunch of factors that fell into place and worked out to make it a state championship sport.
It does seem like a pretty easy lift considering all the things that you mentioned, equipment already in place. In recent decades, I know we've seen more women interested in the game overall. It's almost commonplace now, I believe, for high school teams to have a girl on the roster and for them to get on the field. There are professional women's football leagues, both flag and tackle. What do you think has led to the rise in interest in football, in playing football, amongst women and girls?
I think it's just team competition kind of thing. There's a whole bunch of different sports that different leagues play, different communities play, but there's been kind of more of a rise in popularity, especially how popular the NFL is, and they're trying to expand it to get women's and girls' interest in it as well. So, I mean, you can see it. They've been advertising on Disney Plus and stuff like that, or NFL flag championships. I just think it's just kind of like a popularity thing. Everyone's coming up. All the high schools used to have, they have these powder puff games where the girls actually play flag football games at their homecoming events before the boys' football games that week and stuff. And there's always been kind of a piggybacking interest in it.
When you hear male football players talk about what they love about the game and what they learn from the game, you usually hear things like teamwork and camaraderie and brotherhood. I imagine girls would get many of the same things out of the game, but do you feel that they get something out of it that is unique to just them?
I think across the whole student-athlete experience for high school sports, education-based sports, it's like the second classroom, right? I mean, it's the classroom for the kids after school, so they're learning not only courses that will benefit them in their life, but they learn teamwork, working together, being respectful, cooperation, that kind of thing. So it's kind of like an added classroom at the end of the day where a different set of teachers can, coaches can work and teach them lifelong skills.
So how's it all going to work? When will the season be? How many players get to be on the field? Will the rules and parameters be similar to ones used for the boys? What are some of the major logistics of how it will work?
So it's a 7-on-7 game. So there's 7 players on the field. We're going to play it in the spring, so we'll probably start in mid-February. That'll be the start date. The state championship will be held, I think, the week of April 21st. It's kind of like when we were in high school, they had this pass league going on, so there's no kicking involved. It's pretty much offense, defense, 7 versus 7. I think there's one center that hikes it to the quarterback, but she's eligible once she hikes it. So it's kind of an exciting, fast game. Kind of like the kind we played growing up in the schoolyards that everyone had a blast with. So, yeah, it's an exciting game. It's all passes. There's some runs, but it goes quickly. It goes fast. It's very entertaining. It's fun to watch. So, yeah, I'm really excited about it.
What kind of response have you heard from schools thus far? Has there been a lot of interest from schools?
Yeah, so, like, right now our most popular sport is probably volleyball. I think we have about 75 schools that play, and it goes all the way to other sports where some sports we only have like 24 girls teams. So right now, the interest level, we're at over 50 teams that I think we'll have in the first year. So I'm thinking the number is going to get up close to girls volleyball, but not really. Probably stop in around the soccer range, which is around the 60s. It'll be one of our most popular sports, especially on the girls' side.
Is there any general consensus among the boys playing football as well? Have you heard any feedback?
I mean, it's super new, so I haven't really talked to any schools or coaches like on the boys' side and how they feel. But I mean, they used to do their spring games in the spring, and I'd imagine that this would have been something that they probably would want to participate too.
It'd be pretty cool to support your fellow classmates. In my head, I envision the boys, you know, being on the sidelines as the girls are playing. That'd be kind of cool to see.
Yeah.
What about parents? Have you heard feedback from parents, even in the proposal stage? Was it something that parents were behind as well?
I think it's something that it was a no-brainer from admin to parents to players to students. I mean, from the top all the way to the bottom. I mean, because of the public-private partnerships that were involved, because of the way the Department of Education supported it, that everything was a positive, that if you can add a girls sport, especially in this time frame, especially with these limited costs, that this is something that everyone can get behind.
I did have one question for you that I feel like it might be something that the HHSAA or DOE might have to address in the future. How will the rules address transgender girls who want to play?
Yeah, that's kind of a touchy subject. Right now, I think the department, we had a policy in place which kind of mirrored the college policy, the NCAA policy, but the Department of Education has their own policy, so we had to adopt ours or kind of change ours to match theirs, especially since most of our member schools are part of the Department of Education. So we're kind of handcuffed in a way. We follow a lot of the other states. We have to make sure we follow the Department of Education. So we'll handle it the way that's respectful to all sides, but that's kind of where we're at right now.
What's the vision for the future of girls flag football? What are the HHSAA's hopes that it will become or how it will impact girls in our state?
Well, I mean, it's already a full-fledged state tournament. There's going to be a full-fledged state tournament come the spring. Well, based on its popularity, it'll already probably go to two divisions in the second year, and it'll be just as big tournament as all the other state tournaments. And it's just, this is year one, so we have to figure out how to make the ground running in a smaller tournament, smaller setting. But I imagine by year two, it'll be full-fledged 24 teams, like two divisions, like all the other state tournaments. All the states to sanction it, there's 12 now. We just sent a letter to the NCAA for them to sanction it. So hopefully it'll become a Division I college sport in the near future. I know they're looking at it. It's already at the NAIA level. I think there's 25 other states that are going to do a pilot program this year. So they'll be at 35 states. The NFHS, they're kind of like our NCAA. They're going to write rules on it this coming school year because there's enough interest and participation. So we just hope to grow along with the other states, grow with along the colleges. It's going to be an Olympic sport in 4 years. Hopefully we'll have some of the Olympic athletes participating in girls flag football. So yeah, I expect it to grow the same as with every other sport.
Chris Chun, thanks so much for your time and your insight. Appreciate talking to you.
Yeah, thank you. No problem.
That was Chris Chun, the executive director of the Hawaii High School Athletic Association. He was talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about the plan to offer girls flag football at Hawaii's public and private high schools next spring. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to take a closer look at the election results for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. You have any feedback about the election results? Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.